This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago. And we welcome you now to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Lautman's guest this month features Barry Unsworth in an interview recorded earlier this week. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Scorsese by Roger Ebert from the University of Chicago Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring the Norman McLean Reader, also from the University of Chicago Press. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. There you're invited to discover The Chicagoan, a lost magazine of the Jazz Age by historian Neil Harris. That also published by the University of Chicago Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at MavenChronicles.com. A proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to 2009, the fifth season of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. We have a new president. Isn't that great? Yeah.
Oh. Wow.
Broadcasting here from the Harold Washington Library. Of course, this is our new partnership with the Chicago Public Library, and we're so thrilled with that, and, of course, on WFMT Radio, where this is always broadcast. And we would like to thank, at this moment, MavenChronicles.com, who continue to underwrite the series, and also to thank Seminary Co-op Bookstore, because they are always schlepping copious amounts of books down here. And we're very grateful. You can hear all the past four seasons of Writers on the Record on VictoriaLautman.com. All of them. Juno Diaz, Martin Amis, Edvige Danticat. I mean, there's 4.5 years of really great interviews. Well, some of them are as great as others, but most of them are pretty good. So I hope you have a chance to listen to that sometime. Now, as far as a reason for being here today, you know, I had a really weird experience, weird reaction, I would say, to Barry Unsworth's 16th novel. I have to say, I absolutely loved it. But it also, after reading that book, it forced me to visit the Oriental Institute and reconnect with that incredible collection of artifacts from ancient Mesopotamia. This is going to make sense in a minute. Because then I was forced to spend hours wading through internet entries about early oil exploration and building the Baghdad Railway. And it's because all of these fascinating, at what probably sounds to you like disparate topics, converge in Land of Marvels. And I wanted to know more about those topics, which isn't really surprising for anybody who's a fan of Barry Unsworth. If you've read any of his 15 previous books, you have been plunked into a sculptor's studio in Renaissance Venice, traveled with itinerant actors in medieval England, been aboard a British slave ship bound for Colonial Florida, had a ringside seat for the sack of Troy, and these are just to name a few of the locales that he's covered in his historical novels. Now, Unsworth, Booker Prize winner and international bestseller, turns to 1914 and the crumbling Ottoman Empire on the eve of World War I in an area that we know as Iraq. 1,000 years from now, who knows, maybe it will be the former Iraq. And that, I think, is part of the point. It is such a great pleasure to welcome Barry Unsworth here. Thank you so much for coming to Writers on the Record.
Very glad to be here.
That was a really long-winded introduction, but it's such a complex book, and I think I realized as I was reading it that the names of cities like Baghdad, Mosul, Basra, Tikrit, these names that come up that really have bombarded us in the last, you know, few years as a war zone, many of us have completely lost sight of the fact that the Assyrians laid claim to that territory millennia before any of us had ever heard of George Bush and Saddam Hussein, and ran a pretty good empire for a pretty long amount of time until they crashed and burned, as all empires seem to do, which also seems to be the nature of your interest in this particular story.
Yes, the Assyrian Empire was the greatest empire that part of the world had ever seen, and had a formidable military machine. Started off with a strip of land along beside the Tigris and expanded steadily and got more and more cruel and more oppressive as they went along. But there were empires. I mean, that's a land of empires. I mean, anybody digging there, anyone sort of excavating in what was then Mesopotamia, is digging down through, you know, half a dozen empires, the Roman being probably the most recent, you know. So when I thought of writing the book, it was empires and the overreaching of empire and the seeds of collapse that lie within the empire that was one of the attractive things for me.
Well, the three stories that converge, the three sort of storylines that converge in this book in sort of a calamitous way, eventually, without giving too much away, is the story of a British archaeologist digging at Tel Erdek, which is one of these sites that you're referring to, an archaeological site. Then there is the construction of the Baghdad Railway, which is encroaching on his site, on his you know, in his area, and possible one of the causes of World War I. And also the early exploration of oil in that area. So all of these things are going on in this little tight mode that you're creating. And I was really curious about which one of those stories was the one that drew you into this book, Land of Marvels.
I think it was probably the railway. I know nothing about railways much, but many years ago I made a note about the Malaya Railway, and people were laying a track through the jungle there, and they were trying to open up the market and get to rubber trees. A lot of people died in the process, disease and hostile natives and so on. And all the time back home, they were developing synthetic rubber. So in fact, that whole enterprise and all that sacrifice, you know, was in vain. Was just, and this struck me as sad and ironic, but I didn't do anything with it. And then certain change, it became the Baghdad Railway, which is a sort of prelude to war, reaching towards war, reaching towards the post-war, the future, as I saw it. As everyone knew, there's a lot of oil there, but no one had got permission for any drilling or any concession. It was sort of quite murderous competition, and it was the Germans who were building the railway. They had the permission from the Sultan to Abdul Hamid to build the railway, and they had prospecting rights on either side of the line, 25 kilometers. So they were in a very strong position.
Now that railway, which you do go into a certain amount of the detail in the book, but that was an extraordinary feat in itself. It was meant to link basically what was then Constantinople,
yes,
with the Persian Gulf.
Yes.
And so it was the person that you choose to be really neurotic about the building of it is this guy Somerville, the British archaeologist who has spent 3 years and a lot of his life and most of his money on this archaeological site when he realizes the train is probably going to go right through it.
Yeah, he's afraid that that's going to happen. There are people who feel that they are destined for misfortune, that they are going to be the target of God's anger, so to speak. And he is one of those. I mean, it isn't certain that the line's going to go smack through his dig, but he's obsessed with the fear that it will, which is sufficient. And then the fear and the obsession are what makes him a character in the book, really.
Actually, this is a really good point to read from the early part of the book about Somerville, and we're skipping the part about how he becomes an archaeologist. He doesn't come to it through the normal route of going to school and being highly... He's an amateur archaeologist, which you could be back in those days. And he is such a mope at that point. You know, he's just really feels that the world is against him. He's been working on this site, Tell Erdic, and really not getting very far.
That's right.
So would you mind just reading from that little part towards the beginning where he's talking
Certainly,
about this?
Yeah. Yeah. It had been his consuming passion. In an age of explorers and empire builders, his hero had been an archaeologist, Henry Layard, whose excavations had revealed to the world the glories of ancient Assyria. In 1830, at the age of 22, Layard had given up his position in a London law office and travelled on horseback through Anatolia and Syria. He had excavated Nimrud with its colossal human-headed five-legged bulls, uncovered the palace of Sennacherib at Nineveh, and the many hundreds of cuneiform tablets from the archives of the Assyrian kings, an immense addition to human knowledge. And he was still not yet 30. Somerville, too, in conscious emulation, had given up everything for the sake of archaeology. His mother had died when he was still young. On his father's death, he had sold the business and the family home, invested the money, and offered himself as unpaid assistant to Sir William Forburn, who was about to leave for Mesopotamia. He had always held to the similarity of circumstance between Layard and himself. Their lives were connected by a bright and glittering thread. He too would become famous for his discoveries. He too would reveal to the world a splendor from underground, long unsuspected. He was farther away from this now than ever. By the end of this third season, with the wages of 200 workers to pay and the cost of transport to meet, he would be left with funds insufficient for another year. And now there was this sudden threat of the railway, for both sudden and insidious it had been. In 1912 and most of 1913, during the course of his first two seasons at Tel Erdek, the railway company had run into money problems. The line had been, to all appearance, abandoned. A branch line to Alexandretta had been completed and opened to traffic, but work on the Euphrates Bridge had been suspended. The track had been halted just east of the river and might well have stuck there for some years more. But in the previous December, while preparing to set out, he had learned from the Times that the Deutsche Bank had disposed of its holdings in the Macedonian railways to an Austro-Hungarian syndicate and reinvested the funds thus obtained in the main line, confirming the company's intention of taking it across Mesopotamia to Baghdad and Basra. He had had the proof of it this morning from the mouth of Jehar, who always looked at him so closely and intently, as if something more were expected, awaited, some inevitable end. Once again, with the same feeling of sickness, he was swept by the same question. Was it not he who was waiting for the end, for the line to come and pierce this bump of ancient ground and smash his hopes, hopes smashed already?
Barry Unsworth, reading from Land of Marvels. Oh, let's clap for him. Thank you. You know, It was actually that paragraph that made me run out to the out to the Oriental Institute, because of course they have those enormous gateways from Sargon's palace, and you refer in that to actual people. There are a lot of facts in this book, and then a lot of things that you just sort of have made up as a great piece of fiction. But Henry Layard is one of the actual archaeologists of that time period. And in digging around it, I don't know if this is how you want people to read your books or if it was just my obsession, that I really became so fascinated with the discovery that at that moment, Somerville doesn't realize he's about to make. He thinks he's just about to run out of time. The train is coming anyway. Who cares? He's given 3 years up of his life to this archaeological site, and there's nothing very interesting there until he finds an ivory plaque. Your description of that plaque was so precise. And in the research I was doing about this, I read something, and I think it was The Spectator, that mentioned that it was an actual ivory plaque. There was actually a pair of them, one at the British Museum and one that had been stolen from the museum in Iraq. Yes. And so I went digging through all this stuff. This is the kind of work I do before these, but I was so fascinated by that. And it is, you can see this thing, which was, I guess, a piece of furniture at one time, that you obviously, at some point in this book, decided, I need to find something that he's going to discover. Why did you come up with that?
It's as you say, he needed to start making finds. And in archaeology, a small thing can be very important. A seemingly small thing can be tremendously significant. You know, the base of a wall, the type of brick that's used, and so on. The plaque, I like the idea of the plaque because it's a lion just about to tear out the throat of a Nubian captive, and the Nubian is beneath the lion's body, leaning back, and seems to be offering his throat. He's the victim, and it's a symbol. To my mind, it was a symbol of empire, and it coincided with a lot of the things I was feeling. I mean, it was a celebration of power. And the book is very largely concerned with power in one aspect or another. So I think that was the reason. And then they have to kind of make further finds and interconnected and slowly piece together the fact that this was long ago an Assyrian township, an important place in the Assyrian kingdom.
Now, was that something that you already knew a great deal about? I know you spent a certain amount of time in Constantinople teaching. You were familiar. You've written, actually, Pascali's Island, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, takes place in the same time period in a different location,
yes,
but also concerns archaeology and a certain amount of mystery. And so this is obviously a kind of a hook for you that must allow you to get to a certain thing that you need to express. You seem to know a lot about archaeology.
No, I don't really know much about it at all.
You fake it very well.
I think that, my novels come out in different shapes and sizes, and they're about different things, and they're set in different periods. And so each time I have to try to learn about it and to become familiar, I become a sort of expert for about 6 months, and then I return to ignorance again after that. And it was the same way with this.
But the idea of a tell, one of which is basically, and I was thinking of, you'll probably hate this comparison, but James Michener's book, The Source, from many years ago, which was all